I spent a sabbatical winter here at Holden Village a few years ago and did a lot of reading and discussing on war and peace issues then. And the following January, I team taught an interim course for PLU with Bob Stivers that was held here. So that's some of the context for my discussion today of nuclear winter, twilight for humanity. And there is a question mark at the end of that title, I hope. It is this week that we remember each year the anniversaries of the summer of 1945. On August 6, 1945, at 8:16 a.m., the nature of warfare was forever changed. Three United States B-29 bombers flew over Hiroshima, Japan. One of them dropped one bomb on a parachute. Since there were only three bombers, the all-clear had already sounded. And so many people watched that parachute float down until it exploded 1,670 feet in the air. The immediate results Hiroshima, August 6th, over 5 square miles, immediately reduced to rubble. 92% of the buildings in the city were destroyed. By the end of the year, 140,000 people had died from the effects of the blast and the fireball and the lingering effects of the immediate radiation and the radioactive fallout. But that was not all. On August 9th, at 11:02 a.m., over Nagasaki, Japan, the second bomb was exploded. Then only 2.6 square miles were destroyed, and some 70,000 had died by the end of the year from the immediate and lingering effects of that. Yes, we did. And if anyone wants a really graphic portrayal of the meaning of those cold figures, then for a dollar in the bookstore, you can get a copy of Days to Remember, which is full of photographs and drawings that were collected by a Japanese citizens committee to remind the world of what happened then. Now, those atomic bombs or fission bombs each had a power of, on one hand, 12,000, on the other, 22,000 tons, respectively, of TNT, hot conventional high explosive equivalent. 1 ton of TNT is about the size of the blockbuster bombs that we and the British dropped on Germany during World War II. So 12,000 to 22,000 bombs worth in one bomb. One thing that is striking about the aftermath is what has not happened since. No nation has used such a weapon since those two in 1945 in warfare. So the United States is the only nation in the world who has ever used nuclear weapons in war. Yet countless children and adults throughout the world have been terrorized by the prospect that someday someone will. Albert Einstein, who had a great deal to do with the events leading up to this, said that the unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking. And we thus drift toward unparalleled catastrophes. Now, actually, these two bombs were not markedly more destructive than warfare activities. a few months before. Tokyo, spring 1945, two firebomb raids. Had destroyed 16 square miles and 250,000 of the population died as a result of that, more than the two atomic bombs put together, but many, many bombs it took to do that. Since that time, war has not become unthinkable. Well over 25 million people have died since 1945, and well over 100 wars throughout the world. Still, there is more. Thermonuclear or fusion or hydrogen bombs were developed by the United States and first tested in 1952, by the Soviet Union in 1953. Each of those is 3,000 times as powerful as each of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki type bombs. So their destructive force is measured in megatons, equivalent of millions of tons of TNT, conventional high explosive. As a measure of comparison, during all of World War II, the United States and Britain together dropped something like 2.2 megatons of TNT on Germany. The largest bomb ever tested was by the Soviet Union in 1962 by itself. That was a 58 megaton bomb, or dozens and dozens of World War IIs in one package. Well, there has been no direct evidence of what one of those weapons would do if used in warfare. The Office of Technology Assessment of the United States Congress has published some scenarios of what could happen if, for example, a single 1 megaton hydrogen bomb were exploded on a major city such as Detroit. They project that, for comparison here, one megaton on Detroit projected depending on your scenario, what time of day, what time of week, what time of year, anywhere from 220,000 to 2.5 million deaths immediately, and 0.5 to 1 million serious injuries. Many of those would prove fatal, especially since most of the hospitals would be destroyed or so badly damaged, together with the loss of the doctors, nurses, and other medical personnel, that there would be no possibility whatsoever that the survivors of the blast could begin to get the kind of medical treatment they would so desperately need. Well, that's a projection by a computer based on certain assumptions modeling what the effects would be. Now, the United States and the Soviet Union each have somewhere on the order of 10,000 nuclear warheads in their arsenals. Britain, France, and China each have 100 or 200 each. India exploded what they called a peaceful nuclear device in the year 1974. I don't know whether they maintain a stock of these or not. Pakistan announced about a year ago that they can make one anytime they want to, but didn't announce when they think they might want to. There are many who believe that both Israel and South Africa currently possess nuclear weapons, but don't say so. And there is a substantial list of nations who would have the capability of developing them if they could and wished to devote the amount of resources needed to do that. For anyone who might want to understand a lot about the history, the nature, the policies, and the prospects for these various kinds of nuclear weapons, I can recommend this book, Nuclear War, What's in It for You, published by Ground Zero, which was founded by Roger Molander, who spent 7 years as a member of the National Security Council with the principal area of responsibility of strategic nuclear policy issues. $3.95 in the bookstore. You can see that my copy is well worn. But all of this is only prologue to my topic today, which is a what-if scenario of an all-out nuclear war in which thousands of these warheads might be exchanged. Of course, there are only two nations which possess thousands of them and could exchange them. Not presently in the bookstore, published in 1982, was a book called The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell, in which he examined in great detail plausible consequences of such an event as they could be projected then, prior to 1982. And I would like to read to you a bit of what he has to say. I believe the following judgment can be made, in spite of the limited amount of solid information available. Bearing in mind that the possible consequences of the detonations of thousands of megatons of nuclear explosives include the blinding of insects, birds, and beasts all over the world, the extinction of many ocean species, among them some at the base of the food chain, the temporary or permanent alteration of the climate of the globe, with the outside chance of dramatic and major alterations in the structure of the atmosphere, the pollution of the whole ecosphere with oxides of nitrogen, the incapacitation in 10 minutes of unprotected people who go out into the sunlight, the blinding of people who go out into the sunlight, a significant decrease in photosynthesis in plants around the world, the scalding and killing of many crops, the increase in rate of cancer and mutation around the world, but especially in the targeted zones, and the attendant risk of global epidemics, the possible poisoning of all vertebrates by sharply increased levels of vitamin D in their skin as a result of increased ultraviolet light, and the outright slaughter on all targeted continents of most human beings and other living things by the initial nuclear radiation, the fireballs, the thermal pulses, the blast waves, the mass fires, and the fallout from the explosions. And considering that these consequences will all interact with one another in unguessable ways, and furthermore are in all likelihood an incomplete list, which will be added to as our knowledge of the Earth increases, one must conclude that a full-scale nuclear holocaust could lead to the extinction of humanity. To say that human extinction is a certainty would, of course, be a misrepresentation, just as it would be a misrepresentation to say that extinction can be ruled out. Yet at the same time, we are compelled to admit there may be a holocaust, that the adversaries may use all their weapons, that the global effects, including effects of which we are as yet unaware, may be severe, that the ecosphere may suffer catastrophic breakdown, and that our species may be extinguished. Once we learn that a holocaust might lead to extinction, we have no right to gamble, because if we lose, the game will be over, and neither we nor anyone else will ever get another chance. Therefore, although scientifically speaking there is all the difference in the world between the mere possibility that a holocaust will bring about extinction and the certainty of it, morally, they are the same. And we have no choice but to address the issue of nuclear weapons as though we knew for a certainty that their use would put an end to our species. In weighing the fate of the earth, and with it our own fate, we stand before a mystery. And in tampering with the earth, we tamper with a mystery. We are in deep ignorance. Our ignorance should dispose us to wonder. Our wonder should make us humble. Our humility should inspire us to reverence and caution. And our reverence and caution should lead us to act without delay to withdraw the threat we now pose to the earth and to ourselves. It was the same year that was published that one of the previously unguessed additional consequences he spoke about began to appear in print also. A special double issue of the Swedish environmental journal Ambio was entitled Nuclear War, The Aftermath, and among the number of articles on different aspects of the effects was one which raised, for I believe the first time, the scenario that a major nuclear war might result in surface land temperatures being reduced by as much as 50 degrees in some scenarios for several weeks, which could wipe out agricultural production if that happened in the growing season, or destroy crops if it happened at the harvest season. And the process of that would be just a simple and direct consequence of the optical effects of dust from the tens of thousands of blasts in such a scenario, plus the smoke from the burning cities, burning fuel supplies, burning fields, and burning forests, which would spread across continents and last for weeks. This dust and smoke would block out much of the incoming sunlight and thereby not only cool the surface of the earth but prevent plants from getting the sunlight they need for photosynthesis, growth, and development. Particularly the firestorms in the cities can loft the soot from that burning clear up into the stratosphere, where it can't rain out because there's no rain up there, it's above that level, where we know well from experiments on nuclear tests in the atmosphere and from following what happens after volcanic eruptions, that the jet stream distributes things clear around the world within 2 weeks, and they may persist up there for months or even years. Comparisons of such an effect have been made to suggestions that the mass extinction in the late Cretaceous period might be ascribed to the impact of a large meteorite setting up such a cloud of dust over the earth, and also to possible mechanism of triggering of ice ages in the Pleistocene period because of widespread volcanic eruptions which were far beyond anything which has been recorded within human history. Now, no one does experiments to test these hypotheses about meteorites or volcanoes or especially nuclear holocaust. At least no one would do that experiment more than once if the consequences are what we suppose they may be. So the only way to investigate them is by constructing mathematical models. A model, as used in science, is a deliberate oversimplification. We know that the total situation is too complicated to represent in mathematical equations. So simplifications are made, assumptions are made. This is done deliberately because there's no other way to come up with any answers at all, and the uncertainties and assumptions behind it are very carefully included in the conclusions. Such models have been developed for nuclear winter by atmospheric scientists in the United States, in Germany, and in the Soviet Union. All of them agree in the plausibility of such possible consequences and come up with conclusions that were summarized, for example, by one Soviet scientist as follows. Analysis of the whole problem and discussions with colleagues show that if pollution estimates of the atmosphere after a nuclear conflict are valid, survivors of the first strike would find themselves exposed to fierce cold, darkness, lack of fresh water, food, and fuel, radiation, pollution, diseases, and extreme psychological stress. For these reasons, a nuclear war would mean either extinction of the human race or its degradation to a lower than prehistoric level. Under such conditions, complete disappearance of the human race is possible. These conclusions depend little on the reviewed nuclear war scenarios, different people's models. Only a minor fraction of the world's existing nuclear arsenal is sufficient, if used, to achieve nuclear winter. And this implies, for all practical intents and purposes, that even so-called limited nuclear war is totally destructive. Use of nuclear weapons in whatever size, designation, or yield would result in an ecological catastrophe without precedent in human history. The author of that, Vladimir Aleksandrov, was the head of the Climate Modeling Division of the USSR Academy of Sciences, doctorate in mathematical physics. Before he researched nuclear winter, he worked on climate modeling. And then at the end is this chilling statement. He disappeared while attending an international meeting in Cordoba, Spain in March 1985. Period. Since that time, or by 1985, many more elaborate and presumably more accurate models had been built to investigate this question. And finally, it was investigated by a committee of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States at the request of the Department of Defense, which had not given consideration to this. Well, nobody had before 1982. And the results of these other models indicate that things may not be as bad as the first model suggested they could be. Maybe only a 30-degree temperature drop instead of a 50-degree temperature drop, depending, of course, on the number of warheads, where they're targeted, when, and so forth. But just by comparison, during the last ice age, the average temperature on the Earth was only 10 degrees cooler than it is today. As a result of that National Academies of Sciences study, the Department of Defense accepted the possibility of nuclear winter. But they said that really does not lead to any policy change, but only confirms their present policy, which is emphasizing the need to prevent nuclear war from occurring by the process of maintaining a strong deterrent capacity. Well, I was agonizing over a conclusion for these remarks. I went to the bookstore to see what was on the shelf there that I could recommend to you, and was pondering, where is the hope? Do we place our trust in Mikhail Gorbachev and George Bush? And there on the shelf, I found what I knew I was looking for. By Faith Alone, The Lutheran Looks at the Bomb, by our dear friend Dan Erlander, published here at Holden Village. And its front cover is drawing of Martin Luther holding the bomb and the open Bible on the lectern with Luther's monogram saying Sola Fide, by Faith Alone, from Romans, to the back cover cartoon of Luther throwing the inkwell at the bomb and saying, mine. No. It's hard to resist reading for the rest of the time to you out of this book. or picking juicy quotes from here and there throughout. But I won't cheat you either of the pleasure of reading it yourself or of the opportunity for interaction here during this session that is Holden Village. But I do want to share with you the final words, and that's not unfairly giving it all away. After all, as John Nelson says, as Christians, we already know how the story ends. So, Dan Erlander says, the Scriptures, Old and New Testament, proclaim the promise we trust. The psalmist marvels at God's work of ending war, breaking the bow, and snapping the spear. The prophet sees the day when swords will be beaten into plowshares and spears into sickles, and nation will not lift sword against nation. Paul sees the day when all creation will be liberated, and all beings will fall on their knees and openly proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord. The writer of Ephesians proclaims the hidden plan of God, now revealed, to bring everything together under Christ, everything in the heavens and on the earth. The writer of Colossians sees the cross as God's act of making peace and bringing back to God everything on earth and in heaven. The seer of Patmos envisions the day when everything that lives will praise the one who sits on the throne and the Lamb. On this day, the kingdom of the world will become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ. In a seemingly hopeless situation, Bishop Cleophas Dumeni of the Evangelical Lutheran Obambo-Kabongo Church in Namibia celebrates with these words, because we are Christian, we are slaves of hope. Imprisoned by the same hope, we celebrate. We celebrate what God is doing in the world even today. The Spirit of God is moving, and millions are crying for peace, for an end to the arms race. And the powers of this world are shuddering. We celebrate God's wondrous future. God will bring the day of shalom. As we wait for that day when peace and justice will reign, we resist the powers of death and we joyfully work for peace. As we work, we pray with confident expectation, your kingdom come. Amen. 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 So, there must be some reaction on your part. Who would like to raise the first comment or question?
Was that last part out of Revelation?
Well, the very last part was Dan Erlander's words. I didn't give the scripture references he gives to the Old and New Testament promises, which are in here. The last two of them, when the day when everything that lives will praise the one who sits on the throne and the Lamb, Revelation 5:13, on this day the kingdom of the world will become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ, Revelation 11:15, and I can't hear those words without hearing George Frederick Handel in the background.
Yes. I think the possibility of a nuclear exchange of any significant magnitude is horrible enough without a nuclear winter scenario. I also think that the simplifications in the models, and I'm sure they all ran almost the same model, do truly bring the results into question for the nuclear winter scenario. Mm-hmm. But I don't argue the point that a nuclear exchange is a terrible thing. The solution, which I think is Christian, is, as you said, we have hope and always will. I would hate to think that we put our hope in a communist nation voluntarily giving up their share of the nuclear capability. We haven't seen any evidence of that until Gorbachev came along. And we don't know whether Gorbachev's going to make it or not. So I think our policy has been correct in the sense that we have attempted to deter nuclear war. And you can argue about whether massive retaliation is the best way to deter or a strong defense like SDI. That's a separate argument. The deterrence capability is the important part of the question. If the present trends continue in Russia and they do truly recognize and try to repair the economic damage they've caused their country and their people, then I think we can look forward to a triumph of, let's say, Western civilization and Christianity in this scenario. But if we give up unilaterally our capability, I think we would encourage them to continue their adventure, and it would be counterproductive. So I would worry if we as a church argued for unilateral disarmament. I think that would be a serious mistake, particularly in light of the defense of the last few years.
Rather than me giving the comments,
what I was thinking was it only takes about 100 bombs total, they think. Whether it takes 50, 100, or 150, all the models are hitting around 100 to start this reaction of the nuclear winter. That's not very many bombs, even though countries that don't have very many have 100.
As I say, I question those models very seriously.
If it takes 1,000, why do we need 10,000? I mean, we're really spending a lot of our good money on stuff like that. I mean, maybe we ought to feed some people.
The reason you have to have 10,000 is because you have to be sure that you don't tempt them to attack us. And that's part of this deterrence question. And to the degree that we can agree on reductions bilaterally, fine, I'm all for it. I think everybody is. Nobody wants a war, not even the Department of Defense. Some people seem to forget. But I think unilateral disarmament is very serious. The whole game is perception. And if they perceive that they can be successful, they have to try something. And that's why it's important to maintain some kind of balance.
Just one comment I wanted to make before allowing the rest of you to get into it, and that is, even without nuclear winter, Jonathan Schell had reached his conclusion that there was a plausibility, a possibility, a believability that extinction might result. And that would mean to anybody's that a first strike is potentially global suicide. And that puts an entirely different dimension to it as far as specific policies. And I saw your hand first.
I didn't know quite where to start in a response. I was wondering to start with, are we working under the assumption that Russia is an evil empire as opposed to us being pretty good?
Well, I think, I don't know. The word evil isn't, I don't use and think about much. I think they are adventurous. I think they've proven that since communists took over. That's pretty obvious, I believe. And that's our problem. The struggle in the world is between communism and democracy. And it has been since World War II.
I think it's simplistic, however, in this world as we live right now, to look at us as Russia versus the United States. Especially when you spoke about the capabilities of other countries to establish bombs, those who already have bombs, brings into question the policy of deterrence and makes it much more complicated. Also brings into question, and I think, the Iran-Contra fiasco. Also brings into question the distribution around the world of American military might, militarism that our government purposely does to a country that we, publicly have such low regard for and such contempt for, but yet are willing to deal our weapons to them. So I think it's extremely complicated, and I think it's very simplistic, and I don't think it's look at it as us versus Russia anymore. It's much more complicated.
In the nuclear deal, I believe that's true. I believe it is. It is us versus
Yeah.
Well, there's also an interesting rogue in international situation now, the Bosnian countries and your Gaddafis and some of the fanatical non-Christian, non-Western civilization oriented nations who have the ability, if not to make their own, to buy one or to get one. And that makes a whole different scenario in the international scheme. It's not just the two big superpowers glaring and trading words back and forth with each other. There's a whole lot of crazies in quotations or rogue elephants out there that could change the international situation in a moment. And that frightens me, I think, more than superpowers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that same score, anybody who believes in an arms race as a deterrent ultimately should read a few accounts of the outbreak of World War One and see how they feel afterwards.
There's a hand over here. Well, I concur that. I think it's going to be one of these characters like the mouse that roared. Anyone who gets so alarmed about satanic verses and anything is for sale at the right price, they just might buy one and set it off in Chicago. And if that did happen, who's to say where it came from and what would be our reaction militarily? What would be our reaction if something like that did happen?
Well, that's not a question I'm going to try to answer. I did want to comment that a few years ago, Israel was sufficiently convinced that Iraq was developing nuclear capability to obliterate one of Iraq's power plants in what, strictly speaking, would be an act of war, although Iraq didn't retaliate. Allegedly, Gaddafi has been trying to buy one for quite some time. On the other hand, it was us who bombed him and killed his baby. But,
I was wondering in what way that perhaps approach it from a different angle. In what way can we justify this country's actions, ignoring everything else on a Christian basis? I do believe that the Lutheran Church, not known as the Peace Church, but does prescribe to the just war view. I'd like to know how one justifies anything to do with atomic warfare under the just war view. Or do we not subscribe to that anymore?
Even with the just war theory, as you show with Tokyo being bombed in a number of civilians, because in just war theory it is that non-combatants should be killed. And when we look at it, this is a question that goes on even before.
So how does that
it's the proper question.
How does the Christian in this room justify it under that?
I think we're confusing the deterrence of war with war. And incidentally, the comments about the possibilities of a third nation causing this are excellent arguments for a strategic defense initiative. The bomb in Chicago that you mentioned, sir, if it were delivered by a railway express or so on, we'd know it. You'd know it didn't come from a missile, so you wouldn't attack any of the people that had the missile capability. We would know the difference. So you don't have to worry about that one. Besides which, that one's not going to wipe out the world, and the U.S. is not going to respond. I don't believe, and having worked with the Department of Defense all my life as a civilian, I just doubt. You know, I don't know anybody in the Department of Defense that would be that irresponsible as to make a blind retaliation or anything like that. But as I say, the Third Nation response really is best handled by SDI, unless you believed it was going to be delivered by Railway Express to or Federal Express, whatever the current best transportation method is. Most of them had to be delivered by missile.
Who shot Duke Ferdinand? I guess my question then would be, would we then retaliate if a nuclear bomb were let off in Chicago from the Soviet Union? Would we in fact then commit suicide? Would the United States do that? Would we retaliate?
I would not expect them to, no. That's right. I would not expect
them to. So why do we need the bombs at all then if we're not going to use them? We know we're not going to use them. They know we're not going to use them.
Because we are concerned not about losing Chicago only. We're concerned about losing our country.
Yeah, but we commit suicide if we retaliate. They know that.
But you have to convince them that their first strike, which may not destroy the world, will be successful. That's why.
No president of the United States has ever agreed when he has been questioned that we would not first strike.
That's right.
Mm. None of them.
No, even the candidates, I believe. I guess I have to read more in Gorbachev.
When asked a question, every candidate or president of the United States, would you first strike, they refuse to agree that we would not first strike.
Well, I don't know what they said publicly. I don't read everything they say publicly. But I know from all my experience they would never do that. Now, they cannot in some scenarios, if you will, in this darn scenario, they have to reserve the right to do that, but they would never, as a matter of policy, do it. But they cannot give away that option.
But if you know they never would,
hasn't
it been given away?
I know they never would.
So basically every president we have is a liar. Before you
know it.
Well, that's what we're about here.
Yes, I'd just like to offer a little support for being back to Mickey Adventure. In terms of the modeling, I worked with a number of people who model various other physical phenomena. And generally models, don't predict the right number, but they are quite accurate within factors of 10, maybe. Also, there's a report by the American Physical Society on directed energy weapons, which came out, I think, last year, which I think addresses a lot of the questions of the Strategic Defense Initiative from, I think, hopefully quite a rational point of view. But the major conclusion is that it's not quite possible in the near or foreseeable future to develop the amount of energy needed to make that a viable option.
Yes, that's right. Had the SDI alternatives that are currently under consideration, recognizing that we don't use that again.
Yes.
That's a smart ball. That's smart promise. Yes.
Well, I haven't ever heard the term nuclear bomb used, but I keep thinking of the economic damage that all of us do, all the countries, by putting so much of our money into weapons that kill and do no other good. And I'm just hoping that even the secularists will continue to see the light and see that people need to be fed and clothed and sheltered and so forth and so on, and will just refuse to continue to put money into these systems. I feel that our country is protesting more and more, putting money into. I live near. Near Palmdale, California, so we have had a lot of flack about the self-bombers and the ugly creature, lurking out there on the runway. And certainly Russia is not improving itself, Soviet Union is not improving itself by continued military expenditure.
I think we're close to the resolution of this fight. But all of the other stuff, I mean, so I think maybe they just can't stand the gap much longer regardless of who's in charge, because they think it's terrible.
So are we. Our programs have just gone down, down, downhill. Anybody in social work?
About how many hundred people there are in downtown Seattle. It's appalling. In like the last, 3 years or something?
We're that program.
25% more.
Shelters, everything. Down.
Yeah, I just, I worked in the state legislature for a senator in the last session, and I mean, we've got a drug problem in this country, and if we don't use our money to take care of it, we could spend money. It costs about $8,000 for somebody to go through a good drug program.
2 week program.
Yeah, well, 3 weeks, 3 weeks in the hospital, 16 weeks of aftercare for that person and everybody around them. I mean, everybody around them has to go through the program in a sense, because otherwise you don't know what to do. You just keep assisting them and enabling them to continue. And you don't know how to stop. And I know, because I'm a mother of one.
Well, and then we have the fallout. We have the drug babies, the alcohol babies.
And all these robberies. I mean, I want some money to take care of it.
And I think our congressmen are more.
Yeah. And on the state level, too, they're asking. Well, people are asking.
Been neglecting my job. My life works much better than Reagan, but I happen to think that right now we have one of the best of all opportunities we've had in many a decade to work together with in a supportive way of our politicians. I just came from an ecumenical seminar in Strasbourg, and we can love federation, and we were discussing ethical issues, all the big ones, you know, disarmament and sexuality and so on. And while we were there, Gorbachev came there to address the European Parliament, and his seven-point speech, every one of those 7 points was one of the issues we were discussing. And I doubt if he looked ahead to see what we were talking about, he wasn't prepared. I do think it's not just coincidental that he cares about the same thing. We can say, well, you can't trust Gorbachev. I think we need to take a look at that one and give all the support we can to Bush and Gorbachev and political solutions, because the climate for it is better than it's been in a long, long time. And we'll get around to some of these economic problems and the neglect of social issues if we can just say, hey, look, it's no accident that he cares about those same things. The guy's got some insight. He realizes that the world's in trouble too. And we've had to work, you know, in the past so much in opposition, let's say, to government policy. I think we've got a good opportunity right now.
Yeah, I think that, I agree with that. I think his big problem is to survive his own, you know.
Yeah, he may not survive over there, but Russia will never go back again. He'll never, he can't go home again.
Not completely.
There was a hand here.
I was going to say, I heard somebody, I heard a speech this year in which someone said that peace wasn't the absence of violence, it was the presence of justice. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got, I think as Christian people, what Joel is saying back there, kind of connected with that. I don't think that, when you look at the problem, you look at the problem, there are problem areas in the world. Whether it's violence and unrest, whether it's the Middle East, South Africa, inner city Detroit, Central America, those time bomb areas are areas where we lack human justice. And areas where we have the countries that have the strongest military, El Salvador, Guatemala, us, South Africa, countries in the Middle East, USSR, are not places that are the most secure, the most peaceful. And as Christian people, if we're looking for peace, I think we've got the cart before the horse. I think we have to solve those social problems. We
We have to have justice. We're not going to have peace. I don't care what kind of weapons you've got in this world, we're not going to have peace out of this. We're not going to be saved by the Defense Department. We're going to be saved by the spirit of people.
Well, I have an upbeat bit of news that I just think any Christians would be interested in. Tomorrow, there's a Russian-American Dnipro River peace cruise that will be a 21-day cruise down the Dnipro River, and is sponsored by, I can't remember, some group on the East Coast, and then in Pasadena, Center to Reverse the Arms Race. And the first one took place last year, and the it was just fortunate timing because it began, or took place right at the end of the summit, and Gorbachev wanted to talk to the group for an hour, and Marty Coleman, the head of the Center to Reverse the Arms Race, said, Pasadena said that he was so caught up in it that he stayed with the group over 3 hours, and she said it's required translation, but she said it was the case of just sitting down and talking. And she said, as real people, because she said, I have 10 grandchildren, and I know he has a grandchild, you know. And she said there was real concern there. And the peace cruise itself involves stops at churches along the way. And they, I guess last year, was the group, it's an international group, actually, that's joining them. And they have seminars and person talking with people on the boat every day with the cruise, but they stop at the Greek, Russian Orthodox churches along the way. And they were just so grateful to have the outside world coming to them and helping to talk peace.
Well, thank you. I think that's a very fine note on which to close the formal part of this. I'm sure the conversation will continue. I am always impressed at these discussions of holding at the level of the participation of people who provide dimensions that the rest of us do not possess, and I thank you all very much for your participation.
Thank you.